Welcome back to Business Therapy. This is episode 65. We're the show about exploring the intersection between mindfulness and business. Every week, we sit down with business professionals from all walks of life to discuss how business success can always be balanced with a conscious and grounded perspective. This week, we're happy to have Gordon Graham on the show. Welcome to the show, Gordon.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity.
Absolutely. Gordon is the author of The Intrepid Brotherhood, which is packed full of fascinating topics around business and business culture. So we're excited to learn a little bit more about the book, a little bit more about Gordon, and jump right into the conversation. So with that, Gordon, why don't you give us a little bit of an intro on yourself and the book in general, and then we'll kind of jump in from there.
Sure. I spent over 30, 35 years in the information technology field, mostly employed by hydroelectric utilities in the Northwest, public utilities primarily. And during my tenure at one of those utilities, I experienced and witnessed a dramatic transition in the culture of the organization that I was working for to the detriment of the organization and really everybody in it. And the story, the book that I wrote, the memoir, is really about that whole experience and the lessons in it. I think what I'm trying to convey is that this can happen anywhere and that people who intend to be leaders, and it has to be intentional if you want to be a positive leader and lead people effectively. People who intend to be leaders need to be aware that they can slip into this type of toxic mold if they get too interested in themselves and forget the purpose that was vested in them when they assumed that leadership role. That happened probably mid-tenure at this particular utility. I spent another few years there trying to right the ship, so to speak, until it became obvious that I was going to have to do something different. And before I could lay out a new path for myself, they found what they thought was a reason to be able to terminate me. I came back and eventually gave them an awakening on what they had done. We took them to court and were successful in seeking that justice. Probably the bigger thing is that the book is about my personal experience, but it also brings in the experiences, at least briefly, of some other people who were either working for me or were peers in the organization at the same management level that I was at, who experienced pretty much the same type of intimidation. And that's where the whole brotherhood perspective comes from. Mm. We were all reluctant members of this brotherhood because none of us would have we would have preferred something different. None of us would have chosen that path. And the results were different for probably all of us individually. Some left on their own. Some were terminated and chose to just put it behind them. Whereas in my case, I was forced out, terminated, and came back and tried to expose what was going on at the time.
And Gordon, what was it that was going on? How did the toxic leadership reveal itself in this case?
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Yeah, we had a particular individual that came to the organization, I know, probably 13, 14 years before I had to leave. And he came in at a staff level. He was the internal auditor. So he was part of the accounting function. And he made it known shortly after he came in that he wanted to eventually be in the general manager's office. He wanted to be the CEO, which is fine in some respects. I mean, a lot of people say, well, that's great. If you want to grow your capabilities and grow your responsibility, your span of control, If you want to lend your expertise to the organization in that capacity, that's fine. But I've learned since then that people who actually voice that objective are probably not the kind of people that you want to put into leadership role. If he had come in and made it apparent that he wanted to build his skills and he actually accomplished things that were noticed by others and became recognized and advanced his career through actually growing other people's roles in the organization and providing that kind of support to help other people, his staff members, those within his span, achieve what they wanted to, then hopefully that recognition would have elevated him to where he wanted to be. But instead, he came in and it was obvious after, well, not too long, that his method was to chop off heads. There's a story, a part of the memoir relates how he was a staff member or reported to our treasurer and chief financial officer. And suddenly there was a situation to where that person fell into disfavor with the commissioners. And it was based on a report that the internal auditor did about treasury investments and trades and bond ratings. And some of it was probably a valid observation. Maybe changes needed to be made in how the organization invested and how we were managing money as a utility. But those decisions should have come from conversations between the CFO and the commissioners rather than, an internal audit report actually casting doubt on that person's capabilities and the commissioners looking at it as a terminal situation where they felt like they needed to get rid of that individual. It was probably unjustified. But anyway, that left the opening, of course, and this, of course, the central character in my story just slid right into that role. So that was his first step. And then a few years later, he was made put in charge of our largest generation function as the financial operating officer for that function. Then he became the chief operating officer. And then when the last homegrown manager in the utility retired, the organization was looking for a candidate that could actually respond to most of the emerging issues in the industry, like deregulation and wholesale power trading. And they wanted somebody that had a background or at least exposure to those things. And they decided that they were going to look outside and advertise to the world for an individual who could fill that role. And then suddenly that strategy changed. And a local attorney who admittedly had represented the organization at the state and national level on deregulation issues and relicensing issues was made the general manager. And it was at the suggestion of this the central character in my story, the current chief operating officer, because they were well acquainted, friends in the community, I suppose. And his strategy was, well, this person has had the exposure that you're looking for. Why would you waste your time to go out and look for someone from another utility or someone from the industry when this entity exists in our community? And it made some sense. The individual that they put into that role was a pretty high profile attorney and was capable of building relationships in that regard and solving problems in pretty much any issue or area of utility operations that emerged. But the idea, and we didn't know it at the time, the idea was that between the two of them, they had agreed that this individual, the attorney, would serve as the chief executive officer for a certain period of time. And then when the time was right, he would step aside. And the perception was that then the CFO, who had facilitated his hiring, would just step into his position. And it occurred essentially that way. There was a particular issue that cast some doubt on the capabilities of that attorney who was functioning as the CEO after, I think it was 3 or 4 years. So the timing was perfect to fit their strategy. And he voluntarily stepped aside. Another thing that's revealed in my story is that they had negotiated a very lucrative golden parachute for that individual when he took that role initially, and it raised a lot of eyebrows with the community when that was revealed after he left, that the utility had made this huge payment to this retiring chief executive officer. There was some competition, but it was a facade, kind of a circus for the manager's role. Oh, sorry,
Gordon. Who signed off on this? So, like, did the board sign off on this arrangement? Did they know the arrangement? You know, on any level?
They did. They signed off on the golden parachute, the contract. From the outset, I don't think that many of them ever thought that it was going to have to be fulfilled. I think some of them thought, well, okay, this is a situation where if something arises where he feels he has to leave, or we think he has to leave, in other words, it would be better for the organization for him to step aside then we may have to pay this golden parachute amount. But I don't think many of them actually thought that they were going to be liable for that. It was just something that went into his contracted agreement to serve in that capacity. And they thought it was probably going to be a situation where he served out his contract and left, and the golden parachute was never executed.
Did they know that there was the arrangement that he was going to step aside and the person that hired him was going to assume that role?
No, Sam's shaking his head, and that's correct.
That can't be.
Okay, because that's what I was been shocked about.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Up to this point, so it's already unfolding as this engrossing corporate drama and collusion and almost a bit of conspiracy. So from your perspective being on the ground, did the central character of the story, do you feel that he was self-aware that he was a bad actor, or he felt like he was just playing the corporate game? I know there's a fine line, but it's always the most fascinating part to me about, is this a person who actually had malintent? Or was just ambitious? And what's the take there?
You know, very, very good question, and very appropriate. And you're getting into the material that I have been studying here, somewhat late in life after this whole thing occurred and after I wrote my book, of considering motivations and the whole question about who gets power, who gets to keep it, and why we actually put those people into positions of power. And, and whether or not, based on their behavioral characteristics, that they realize who they are, what they're doing, and that they're comfortable with it. And the nutshell answer to your question is yes. I think he knew who he was and what he did, and he did it willfully. In every instance, I just don't think, from what I've learned, from what I've read, and there's some great books on the subject, I don't think people in that mindset have the capability to feel the things that all of us on this screen do. they just don't react the same way, and they don't have the same remorse, perhaps, that most people do. It's unfortunate, but there are there are many, many of those people out in the corporate world. And that's part of what this book is about, is being able to watch for that, especially if you're in a oversight role, like a commissioner, a board member. You actually do hiring and firing of and reviews of that level of executive. You want to be aware and you want to watch for certain things. And he was fully aware of what he was doing. And go ahead.
So your conclusion is that most CEO roles are filled with sociopaths.
I didn't say that. No.
Aware of their actions, but
no,
have no empathy. No.
No. Yeah. Thankfully, no. Most is not a term that I would use, and I think things are changing for the better at a much more rapid rate than people would realize, just because there's such an emphasis on it in the community. You look at social media now. That phenomenon and how things like inspirational leadership and servant leadership are just permeating management and leadership forums. It at least has to cause people who may have these types of characteristics to look in the mirror. I think they have to look at the things that are permeating leadership training now and go, gosh, if people are thinking this way and I'm acting this way, then how far am I going to get, or how long am I going to be able to survive? So I think things are getting much, much better. But because of certain things, just in our society and in the corporate world, certain things that we do, things that have become ingrained, like the way that we hire people, what we look for in an executive. I agree with a lot of the authors these days that those things have to change. We have to look at that role differently, who fills that role differently, and who's going to be successful for themselves and the organization and everybody that works for them. So no, I don't think most CEOs or people that fill that role, are sociopaths. Interestingly enough, I've hesitated to use this word, but there have been actually many podcast hosts that I've talked to on this subject and about my book, and they come right out and say, oh, you ran into a psychopath in your organization. And I hesitate to characterize him or anybody else that way. But most of the books that I picked up recently on this subject that describe him to a T, I mean, from the moment I open the front cover and start reading, the characteristics that they convey are this guy. And what I was trying to labor under during my time there and when he was the CEO. And the word that they use with no reservations at all is psychopath, or at least psychopathic behavior. It's really, really interesting that you brought up the
there was the whole a study. Idea. There was a study I read. I don't know how long ago it's from. And it's just explaining how psychopathy or sociopathy, I always mix them up. Is on a spectrum. So it's not like, you know, just like all of a sudden there's a line, and that there is a lot of overlap between, like you said, the skills that are required or the characteristics that allow somebody to rise and that have that ambition drive them, and the traits of, at least on the spectrum, of sociopathy or psychopathy.
So. Well, and I would add here that, and I think, Gordon, you started to talk about it, the idea that there is a pyramid or a hierarchy, it naturally promotes this kind of behavior in some ways. And that's what we have to challenge, I think, systemically, if we're going to fix business culture. Because for someone to rise to the top of a pyramid, they in some ways, at some point in their uprise, have to be somewhat exploitative. You know, it's a model that favors dominant alpha male characteristics. And this has been a complaint from a number of groups and angles. And you almost wonder, you know, you kind of started the discussion by saying, well, these are the characters we have to watch out for. but it's not even, it's the role that we're actually hiring for. In a way, I feel like there's some diametrically opposed issues there, because if you're going to be on the top of all of your colleagues, in a way, you have to have some less empathy. You have to be able to be somewhat exploitative, because otherwise, I don't think if you were a conscious individual, you'd feel comfortable sitting on top of all of your colleagues. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, you do. You absolutely do have to be somewhat exploitative in that role. And you can do that successfully if you concentrate on the other things from a servant or inspirational leadership perspective. If you are being exploitive to enhance or promote the mission and vision of the organization, the stated mission and vision, the one that everybody should adhere to, then, you know, some exploitation is justifiable. Also, if your exploitation emphasizes or promotes adhering to compliance requirements in the organization, if everybody is adhering to things the same way, then you won't have the situation emerge where it appears that there's disparity or rules for thee and not for me. And everybody can see that everybody's pulling or pushing in the same direction. I guess you can be exploitive to a degree in executing policies and procedures that promote everyone in the organization realizing their own goals and objectives. So exploitation is not necessarily a bad word, as long as it's not something that is done through a culture of fear and intimidation and creating a toxic workplace, or just because it's a means to an end. You know, something from a Machiavellian perspective that, well, I don't care, you know, what happens to this group over here, because it accomplishes what I want to from a long-term perspective. So those people are just superfluous.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. As soon as you said you introduced this concept of positive exploitation, I bristled internally, because I thought, oh, that seems contradictory. And exploitation normally has a negative connotation. So I thought, I'm going to resist this point. But the more you spoke about it, I started to process and think, well, maybe there is, as long as it's transparent. Because in some ways, I guess it might not even be the term exploitation, but you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost sounds like you're articulating, as long as somebody who is a leader, for instance, might use the resources or delegate or take someone else's time, I guess as long as they're open about it and it contributes to a positive culture, that kind of behavior is okay. I don't even know if I'd call that exploitation. It's an interesting conversation in semantics, I suppose.
No, I don't think you would, because it does have a negative connotation. Yeah, and that's probably the wrong word. I should have challenged that initially, but it's really just working within prescribed systems and limitations to accomplish what is good for the organization and everybody. And so sometimes it might appear like it is exploitative to a certain degree, but it's really fitting the whole process into the mission and vision of what you're trying to accomplish. So, maybe exploitation is the wrong term.
I personally don't have a problem with it. To me, it's like getting the maximum out of something, you know. So, but it also sounds like toward what end? So if it's if it's for the individual's benefit as opposed to the entity's benefit, is there an element of that, like in terms of like toward what end this exploitation or this maximization of resources is done?
I think everything that somebody at that responsibility level does has to be done from the perspective that being good for the individual is going to be good for the organization, and not the other way around. So if you're executing things, policies, procedures, compliance requirements, strategy, from the perspective that we're gonna provide this benefit to the customer, and we're gonna enhance the capabilities of our staff members to be able to do that to fit the strategy, then I think you've closed the loop, and it's benefited everybody. If we have some shortcoming in this area as far as staff capabilities, and this is the strategy we're trying to achieve to provide better benefit to our customers, then we need to enhance those capabilities in those individuals in order to be able to do it. And once you've done that, you've accomplished the strategy, then you've benefited the entire organization. So I think it goes hand in hand. I think really the bigger problem, I mean, all that stuff may be pie in the sky, and you may not be able to find that individual to be able to execute those things right out of the box. But if the organization makes the investment, or at least makes it clear to that individual that part of their responsibility is taking care of themselves and enhancing their capabilities to be able to do the same for everyone that works for them, then I think you can actually accomplish what you want to in building the right kind of CEO, the right kind of person to lead your organization. The contrast is what we were talking about before, which is our systems now, and maybe that's the biggest problem, is the way that we seek and hire people to put in those positions. Because like you say, if you're full of bravado and boisterous and you concentrate on conveying what you've accomplished and what you think you can do for an organization, it attracts a lot of attention. I mean, everybody's aware that everybody who's involved in an interview process, if you sit down and you're trying to hire a candidate, the people that come in front of you and they've got portfolios of projects that they have completed. They've got testimonials from organizations that they have worked for, done consulting work for. They talk about themselves to a great degree and are very, motivated to a degree at their own self-promotion. Then, you know, they may not be the best candidates because they could have those characteristics when they are in that role that put them in that category of, I think Brian Claus wrote a great book called Corruptible, and he says that there is a dark triad of behavioral characteristics. The first one is Machiavellianism, where the end justifies the means. So they believe that anything that they can do is justified if it accomplishes what they want. And then there's, I mentioned that and now I can't. But the last one is the psychopathy, characteristics of being able to persecute or intimidate someone without any remorse at all.
The classic leader profile of our time, basically.
Yeah.
I think Gordon, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of something that could change it in the interview process is, as opposed to finding candidates who speak about what they've accomplished, finding candidates who speak about the leaders that they've helped nourish and create, or the teams that would give testimonials on their behalf on what was accomplished as a team and the like. I think that is one of the things that is changing on some level, is that some of the more progressive organizations do see their leaders as people who are facilitators rather than owners of all the credit or, you know, of all the glory. So
that's a perfect term, facilitator. And I'm glad you brought that up. That's a perfect way to describe it. Just an example in my story in the book, when this event occurred where the attorney that was made CEO or general manager for a period of time, when he left and they did the facade, the kind of charade for manager search, they had two internal candidates. And this is related in the book. One of them, of course, was this person who eventually prevailed and became the CEO. And the other one was someone that I had been there and I'd worked with my entire tenure at the organization for, 23, 24 years. And he had grown progressively in the organization to the C-suite level. He was one step below the manager's office in the executive level. But he had done it through, he'd done it the right way, the way we talked about before, by enhancing those who worked for him and proposing things that would benefit the organization, not necessarily demanding credit for everything that he had done. But he was recognized enough for what he had done and the way that he had done it, that he was at that level to where he expressed an interest in the chief executive officer's position when the commissioner said, well, is there anybody else in the organization that would like to run for this? Which is kind of an interesting concept of having an election or what appeared to be an election in an organization like that for a chief executive office. And it really was. I mean, they did public forums or debates. Debates in front of the employee population. They did a number of them. So it really was an election. It was funny. Anyway, he would have made a much better chief executive officer just because of the type of person that he was. And it should have, by that time, been apparent to the people who made that decision that would have been a much better choice. That chief operating officer had established with certain members of the board of commissioners, and
they're saying the election was rigged.
Yeah, well, I guess that concept never really crossed my mind, but it was. Yeah, I mean, it was obvious the final vote was an interesting thing. It appeared the first time they cast ballots, and I don't know why they did it a second time, but
recount
on the yeah, there you go. The first round, it appeared that the right candidate was going to prevail, and maybe it was just they only balloted once or voted once. And they did it by roll call, I think. It was by voice. And the first, so we had seven commissioners, I think, and the first three voted for the right candidate. So it was like drum roll. And everybody thought, well, he only needs one more. And then the last four voted for the wrong guy, right? And it was choreographed. It had to be really interesting, but yeah, funny stuff to reminisce about that. But yeah, he would have made a much better candidate. I probably would have finished my career there. But I was already at odds with the person who prevailed in that capacity because I had approached him when he was chief operating officer about integrating information technology into the strategic planning of the organization. And that's really what the book is about, setting the stage for his intimidation of me and my department. I had talked to him about some things that were emerging in the industry that were providing a lot of benefit to organizations, getting information technology more integrated into strategic planning so that we could respond better to the things that the industry was imposing upon utilities like ours. And he didn't want to give me any credibility at all. As a matter of fact, when I talked to him about that, it was like he took offense to the idea that I could bring something up that he had not recognized, and that I could make a case based on industry standards and what Duke Energy was doing and what other utilities, even public utilities of our size around the nation were doing, was completely contrary to anything that he was willing to accept. And so I was targeted from that point forward. I had made my own bed, so to speak, and there really wasn't anything I could do to crawl out of that hole. So the rest of the story is about just trying to live under that persecution and what we did to try to excel or succeed, even in the face of that kind of management. And
what would you recommend to somebody who finds themselves in that kind of scenario?
Corporate tyranny or under the heel of corporate bullying, I guess.
You know, I did a piece at the request of my self-publishing and marketing company last year, and it's on my website, but it really, I would expand it now or change it, but it's really, it's not bad advice. It's not for everybody, but it's got some things on how you recognize that type of situation in your own company, the dysfunction, because that's what is the main product of that type of leadership is total dysfunction of the organization. Nothing's running smoothly, and it's pretty easy to recognize. And then it talks about how to recognize the fear and intimidation culture and things like the compliance issue we talked about before, how if an executive in that capacity creates a situation where it's apparent that they don't have any regard for the rules of the organization, they're going to operate the way they want to, but you better toe the line and adhere to every one of those, or else it could be an excuse to get rid of you. So the rules for thee, but not for me type of scenario. And then things like, the persecution, the undeserved promotions, constant chaos, it's easily recognizable. So your question was, what do you do about it?
Well, yeah, if you find yourself in that situation, what would you recommend someone should do?
The first and most ideal solution would be if you could make the individual responsible for those things aware of what you're seeing, aware of the damage that may already being done or could be done, and achieve an awakening in them to where they at least start talking about, well, what can we do to change this? Or, gosh, I'm culpable for that. I need to take responsibility for you're absolutely right. What can I do to change that? Well, this guy didn't have the capacity to accept responsibility for anything like that. But that would be the ideal solution if you could achieve that awakening in that individual and start to turn things around. Probably not frequently successful. But then the next step would be kind of the intervention approach, where if you can build enough a recognition in people at your peer level in the organization. So the rest of people at the director level that I was at, if I could get enough support from them, or at least admission from them that, yeah, this is going the wrong way, or, you know, that was probably not the best decision that the CEO could have made. Let's go as a group and see if we can get him to talk about this. Then that's kind of the intervention approach. He made sure that I was persona non grata, and that's conveyed in the story. And so it was almost impossible for me to build that coalition in the organization. There was recognition. You could tell when I talked to other directors about what was going on that I got a lot of head nods and, yeah, you're right, but nobody wanted to put on that suit of armor and march into his office with me. So the second solution there was, or option there was not a solution for me either, but that intervention approach, I think, should actually be able to accomplish a great deal. The third one, failing those other two, would be to approach the people that have oversight responsibility. So you've got directors probably who are tremendous stakeholders in the organization, and they have this responsibility of oversight to make sure that that people at his level, because he reported directly to them. I mean, they hired him and they reviewed him and he reported to them. They have this responsibility to make sure that people at that level in that office are adhering to the mission and vision of the company, the administrative instructions, compliance issues, personnel treatment, all those types of things. And so you should be able to get the attention of at least one of them, who then could talk to the rest of the board members and maybe get, maybe not a majority, but at least a few of them to start the conversation and have them approach the CEO about, hey, we've had a number of people bring this to our attention. We need to open this up for discussion, become more transparent about it. How do you respond to this? And can we maybe achieve something that can benefit all of us in this arena? So failing that, the last and final option that I have in my my piece that's on my website, the strategies for dealing with dysfunctional organization, is to go public. And that's eventually what I did with my whistleblower petition about what was going on at the organization, primarily in regard to mismanagement and overspending on a huge software project. But it was really everything that was insidious in the organization, in the from the management perspective. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. But it is an option in the end. If you don't just want to walk away and you do at least want to expose what's going on in the organization from the perspective that you're actually trying to heal something, that by throwing the covers back, that people are going to see it, at least the customer owners are going to see, hey, this is what this guy's been doing, and we need to hold him accountable. And that's probably, in the end, it probably had a lot to do with the fact that after he was successful in sending me down the road, he was gone within 16, 18 months, I think, maybe less, because there was just too much public outcry and it wasn't wanted in the community anymore. So it's kind of a long-winded answer, but
You speak to the person. If you think the person isn't going to be receptive or even capable of being receptive, build a coalition on the same level as you. If that can't work, go to the oversight, like the board. If that can't work, then the next one would be going public. Was the how are profits doing at during this time?
So if you look at things like wholesale power sales, which was, I mean, it was a windfall for generation utilities in the Northwest when power was deregulated. Before it was re-regulated and they set a cap on the price, Northwest public utilities or utilities that generated power and had surplus beyond what they had committed made a lot of money. And so wholesale revenues, if you look at that during the period of time that he was there, it was very good.
So but, that probably makes it a lot harder to get people to listen.
Well, to a degree. But if you look at the fact that the manager that came in after him, because of expenditure, you know, you got, it's just like everything else in your family, in government, you got this much money coming in. If you've got more going out,
it was an accident of him being like the time he was there.
Yeah,
but just from experience, like people are less likely to rock the boat. You know, if it seems like something's okay, you know, like could it be that we're all crazy? You know, and like you said, sometimes the answer is yes. You know, I've gotten calls like that from people saying, this happened at work. Does this make any sense? I'm like, no, it does not. You know, but like when you're in the culture, it could, you start getting conditioned to what's normal. So,
yeah.
So just to answer your question directly, the manager that succeeded him was dealing with budget problems for at least 5 years after, to the degree that I think 3 years after he came, or in the budgeting cycle for the third year of his tenure, they created an early retirement scenario for people, you know, people in the organization, so that they could reduce that liability, that commitment, and take that piece out of the budget, just to be able to balance it. So he assumed a very unbalanced situation when he came in, just because of what the previous manager had done as far as commitments for expenditures and some other things like low water flow and less power to sell. But it was really mostly a situation that had been snowballed over the previous years and built this this budget liability that was unsustainable.
Got it. Well, we could probably ask a million more questions, Gordon, because it's a fascinating scenario, but we're about at the end of our time. And I wanted to thank you for not only coming on and sharing a little bit more about the book, but also just writing about your experience so that other people could be more aware and be more equipped to handle these kind of toxic situations. So before we wrap, is there anything else, last thoughts you'd like to share about your book or with our audience?
Well, the only thing that I think the marketing approach that I've taken right now is it's real. I've gotten a lot of feedback recently that it is the perfect case study for a toxic leadership piece in management leadership programs at the college and university level. So I'm going to push that and see if I can get some recognition for that, maybe some acceptance, because it really is should be an eye opener for any student that wants to be a leader, anybody who thinks that they might want to be in an oversight situation, like a board member of anything, any organization, really, to watch out for, you know, the types of things that are conveyed in the leadership model that's in that book. Yeah. And then I got my website, which I think you guys are probably going to put up as part of the piece when you release this. It's got my blog out there, and I don't hit that real often, but I try to do it like once every 2 weeks with leadership topics and some things from my personal past as far as employment experiences and things that I think are going to help people actually attach to themes in the book and interpret them better. All these podcasts, I've got a catalog out there to where people can play those if they missed them. Yeah, the website's probably the best place to go to learn more about the book and about me and just stay in touch.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Gordon, for coming on the show. And for those of you listening, check out the Intrepid Brotherhood. And otherwise, we will talk to you next week. Thanks a lot.